Seattle's Morning News. Welcome to Wednesday, and welcome to Felix Bunnell, who's brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors, our resident historian. When the city of Kirkland published a document last week about the Native American history of the land before it came Kirkland, one local historian was not very happy, and so Felix decided to get to the bottom of this story.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, you know, this is an exciting and dynamic time to be interested in local history. You know, with the intersection of great social change of just the past few years, along with a decades-long expansion of what truly counts as history, and along with the spread of social media, there's never been more information available to those who seek to know about the past. And so the city of Kirkland just published what they call the Kirkland Native History Document. It's 16 pages, tries to do a deep dive on indigenous history there. They talk about 12,000 years of habitation, settlement patterns, native languages, the treaties. They include tantalizing details about two winter villages that once stood in Kirkland and wetlands at the mouth of Juanita Creek where lake people cultivated Wapato. But not everyone's happy with the final product. You might remember Matt McCauley. He's a Kirkland historian who solved the mystery of Kellogg Island in the Duwamish River a couple years ago.
Yes.
And we talked to him about the old shipyards of Kirkland. He's been doing Kirkland history for decades. He thinks the Kirkland Native History Document it just could have been better.
I have to make clear, I appreciate the sentiment here. I'm really glad that the city, you know, Kirkland used to be very proud of its being the most historic community on the east side. And, you know, there was a lot about that. Like when I was a kid growing up in the 70s, it was all about, you know, Peter Kirk and the steel mill and all these sorts of things, and kind of drifted off that. So initially when I saw this document, I thought, hey, cool, this is great. They're putting some resources into some original research here. And so it was a little disappointing that it wasn't a better final finished product.
So we'll hear more about Matt's specific complaints in a moment, but I reached out to the city of Kirkland and talked with Deputy City Manager Jim Lopez. He told me that around the time of George Floyd, some city of Kirkland employees saw an opportunity to address one aspect of how the city presents itself to the public.
Our staff kind of noticed documents and photos and images around City Hall were really post-colonial. And, you know, we're in the work, and we were at that very same time thinking of doing a land acknowledgement to honor the native roots of present-day Kirkland. So it's in that context that staff came up with this idea of creating a hyper-local narrative history document for Kirkland.
So what they wanted to have was one of those land acknowledgments where they say this is the land traditionally of these different people, but they wanted more to it. They wanted to have some context to share with it, which I think is a good idea. But Matt McCauley's issues with the document are that it's incomplete. He says there's more to the story, such as some Duwamish descendants never left Kirkland. They intermarried and remained part of the community. And this might sound a little inside baseball, but Matt says inside baseball is exactly what an official history, something authored and shared by a government entity, that's what it should be.
You know, you have to make sure this stuff is tight when it's going out. Do the sources all match up in the footnotes? Or you know, it's got to be accurate because it's history. And what happens in the case of this stuff from a government organization is the internet is forever. People are cutting and pasting that stuff. They're using sources of Wikipedia. And when something is wrong, it just keeps getting repeated and repeated and repeated over and over and over for years and years. So I'd like to avoid seeing that happen in this case. And just to maybe have them go back and revisit it a little bit and tighten it up would be satisfactory to me.
You know, and Jim Lopez says at the city says it's a living document, and they welcome a conversation with Matt to help make it better. You know, along the way, they had help from historian David Berge. He wrote that amazing Chief Seattle book a couple years ago. They met with tribal people, Duwamish, Muckleshoot, Snoqualmie, and Suquamish, and shared drafts and incorporated feedback. So to their credit, they did put in the work. And in checking with some colleagues, I think Kirkland may be the only city in King County who's commissioned a project like this. And my sense is that outside of Seattle, you know, here the Port of Seattle has renamed parks using the Lachute seed. So you see the sign. And if you don't know that, you see the characters. It's, you know, right. It's an indigenous name. Just outside the station here, they have the Cheshahood Lake Union Trail. There's
Shut
a layer.
I said Cheshahood, but Cheshahood?
Yeah, I'm not sure on the pronunciation myself, actually. See, but there's a sense here that there is a native history that predates the arrival of Europeans. Now, I think Kirkland's leading the way among suburban cities, honoring original residents, unlike anybody else on the east side. Now, being first can be challenging. I talked to Ken Workman. He's a descendant of Chief Seattle, a member of the Duwamish tribe. He reviewed a draft of the Kirkland document before it was published, and he's satisfied with it, and he knows it can evolve. And Ken Workman says, we are in a more enlightened era when it comes to local indigenous history. Just personally, he's seen a lot of changes over the decades.
It was only okay to be native only in the last 40 years, 30 years, maybe 50. But to be a native person out here was not good. And in my family, it was buried, absolute buried. You do not talk about it. You do not admit it. You fit into this dominant culture as best you can. And so how do you record these histories when, in fact, there's so much, my word, trauma that it is shut down? And my grandmother went to her grave, and she would not tell these things to her children and grandchildren.
Yeah, so, I mean, and that's true. It's really
so
the last couple decades. It
was just shame?
Yeah, and because of intermarriage, someone didn't visually look like they were a Native. You couldn't identify someone, but Ken is a descendant of Chief Seattle. And add to this the fact that the indigenous culture here for thousands of years had no written language. It's an oral tradition. And so when a dominant culture moves in the way the Europeans did 200 years ago, and their written culture is here, the victors write the history, right?
I get that.
But they've been working to correct that. And it's sort of like there's two different worlds. And in those two worlds, Ken Workman doesn't see contradictions or tension between the Native culture and the origin stories about things like, you know, the weather and the landscape and the modern science that explains those things. He says, you know, the cedar tree is a perfect object and metaphor for how the old and the new can intersect.
What other tree would you pick out here in the Northwest that would have such utilitarian value? It's absolutely amazing. How do you translate, or how do you tell modern people about these ancient connections? And that's how. So what I tell people is, you want to save the planet, plant a tree. You'll sequester carbon, you get oxygen, and it'll help everybody out.
So, you know, these place-based stories, I have a lot of optimism about how these things get worked out. And ideally, Matt McCauley's going to get together with the City of Kirkland folks. I talked to Jim Lopez about what they might have started. You know, it seems like a big opportunity exists on the east side to do things like put up signs in Lachute Seed, find ways for all those communities to work with each other and with tribes to illuminate indigenous history. And in talking about it, he seems genuinely excited.
Felix, I can tell you, honest to goodness, we would love it if this inspired that kind of movement on the east side. We'd be a part of it. Kirkland would be a part of it.
Yeah, and we'll have links to all the documents in My Northwest. One of the things they used to write their 16-page report was this 95-page research piece by David Berge, the Chief Seattle author. Goes into incredibly deep information about what was going on in Kirkland before it was Kirkland. The other thing, there's all kinds of archaeological sites on the east side that haven't been fully explored and that oftentimes you have to keep secret because they don't want people looting them. And then you can't underestimate the power of somebody like Matt McCauley, kind of the cranky historian. I think, didn't Margaret Mead say something about don't think that a cranky historian can't change the world? In fact, I think the only thing that ever did change the world was a cranky historian.
Well, something along those lines. But, I mean, you now see us in this effort to try and meld our energy-intensive civilization with something more in harmony with the earth for our own self-preservation, when we have living among us the descendants of the civilization which for thousands of years had figured out a way to thrive without ruining everything.
Yeah, in the same place that we all love, that we all want to see thrive, and that we all want our families to thrive in. So I think I'm very hopeful about these things being able to be melded.
Yeah. Historian Felix Bunnell, you can find all of his features at mynorthwest.com. Thank you, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
It has been growing for years. A sprawling homeless encampment nestled in the hills along the Green River between Kent and Auburn. And now a King County Council member is proposing a pilot program focused on cleaning it up. Tyra News Radio's Hannah Scott got an up-close look, and she joins us now. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. So I was out here yesterday. And basically, as you make your way through the South King County neighborhood, it's right near Green River Road and 94th Place South, every so many feet, you start to see these huge mounds of garbage that really make sections of this neighborhood look similar to a landfill. There are cars, RVs, and vans parked along all of the roadway. Each of them are somebody's home. And that's where we found Donna. She was living in her minivan, which she's called home now for close to 4 months, ever since her landlords raised her rent on her one bedroom by half. From $900 a month to $1,800, way out of her price range. She doesn't have any substance abuse or mental health issues, but is somebody that's just fallen through the cracks of the homeless system as she continues to wait for a more private housing option rather than just your regular congregate shelters, which she says just don't work for her, and here's part of the reason.
But I don't want to be in a shelter because there's other people there, and they shut the light off, and you don't know when you fall asleep who's going to rummage through your things. Honestly, my stuff got stolen. I mean, it's a good program if you can have a backpack that has a big, heavy lock on it so that nobody can get in, but a lot of them carry knives.
And she admits that and other things in these shelters and her current situation, just being in her van, can be frightening sometimes, because just to the left of where her van is parked is just this big hillside. It just looks like greenery. It's a very, very steep hill. It has some homemade steps built into the dirt inside that is part of the hill. And it is full of homeless encampments. And Donna says she gets scared in her van at night.
People that come knocking on your door and they want a blue, and I don't know what a blue is. And then there's people that knock on your window and they say, I'm hungry. And then there's people that knock on your window, you know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and they don't, they're cold. And so I give them a blanket, because I get a free blanket, but I'm inside. So I give them the blanket because they don't have shelter. So it's, you know, you got to give a little to get a little. And I pray every night, so I got that going for me.
She's got a great attitude. She's hoping to get a tiny house, so she's on the wait list. Along with us for this tour yesterday were a couple of sheriff deputies who are out here. They aren't dedicated, like, navigation team members. They don't have that in King County, but this property is part of the county roads property. So that is what they are tasked with investigating. So they are out here, nonetheless, dealing with these folks on a daily basis, interacting, just like we talked about with the social worker deputy teams in Snohomish County. It's all about the getting to know these folks and having a relationship, a rapport, if you will.
Every single one of these folks has a story, and they're people, and they deserve to be treated as such. I know every one of them by name. And like I said, I could tell you their stories. I know who's got cancer, who had a son that died of a drug overdose last week. And I feel like we are sounding the alarm on this, and there's never any actionable change. And I got to be honest with you, if my brother or sister was living down here and this was allowed to continue, I would be beyond without words. This is despondency, and this is not okay.
That's also his neighborhood. He happens to live in that area and is heartbroken by what he sees. So this is Councilmember Reagan Dunn, who announced some legislation yesterday to address this particular encampment. It's been around that the area there has been a problem with homeless for years and years and years. But especially, he says, recently, as you've seen new Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell and the state kind of team up on clearing some of the encampments along our freeways, they say more people are now very rapidly moving up into these hillsides where you wouldn't know they were there for the most part unless you went up in there. And once you get up there, I mean, there's just everything. There's big piles of bicycles. It looks possibly like maybe there's some thefts that go on, and maybe they, you know, sell some of the items that they have or take them apart for parts. You've got baby carriages everywhere. I saw studio lighting for like a stage, just mounds and mounds of garbage up this hill. Very unsafe and not humane at all. So Dunn says King County Public Health has had a ban on clearing any camps like this because of COVID. He wants that to change.
Now, we have lived through a couple years of pandemic and vaccines are widely available, that we need to start revisiting the issue of being able to remove and move these individuals out of these encampments. Today, I'm dropping legislation that will use this location as a pilot project designed to try and get individuals moved from this encampment to the wraparound services that exist, including drug and alcohol counseling, mental health counseling, the various shelter services exist, as well as affordable and subsidized housing. It doesn't all have to happen tomorrow. It has to happen over a period of time to see if we can do it.
Okay, but do these services actually exist? And here's my question: if they're out of sight and they have stories like Donna's, Nobody hates people who are just down on their luck, right?
No.
We're worried. We don't like it's the criminals and the druggies. Is there no safe place where if people have no other place to go and they've got a tent, they can camp there with a sanitation? I mean, we used to do that for people in RVs across the country, and, you know, paid campgrounds.
Yeah, actually, she even talked about it. I didn't put that soundbite in there of her, but she said, you know, camping as a kid, we used to love it. She said, this is a very different experience. And you don't know, right? Because a lot of the folks who are a part of that encampment, maybe they have drug issues. And so there is no oversight and safe, you know, camping area for these folks. There is discussion going on right now about some RV safe lots, both at the city of Seattle mm-hmm. and at our regional homeless authority. But, I mean, they're not, I think they're minimal. It's under 100 spaces, if I'm remembering correctly. We'll see how that plays out in the upcoming budget. But it's still, it'll be the fourth, fifth, sixth budget year that I've heard discussion about right. this, and you never really see anything.
I mean, camping always seems to come, there's always going to be somebody who has no other alternative but to set up a tent and just try to keep body and soul together until something changes for them. And at some point, don't you have to acknowledge that? Try to make sure that there aren't any unsafe people there, screen it somehow. But are you think we're ever going to build? Are we all ever going to build enough actual permanent housing for all those people?
There is a lot of permanent housing that is in the works that will be coming online over the next few years. There's more now than there was a year ago at this time, and it's great. It's perfect. But listen, the basic count for the King County, for King County, for homeless right now is 40,000 people.
Yeah.
There's, so, as, and we were talking about this yesterday, as many people as you see lining the sidewalks of Seattle or other areas, urban areas of King County, there are double that, at least, up in these hills that people do not see, that you don't. I mean, it's literally someone's backyard. And I've never seen an encampment like this. I mean, how steep this hill is, everything you saw out there was just incredible. So Dunn's point with this legislation is to, right, we have the Regional Homeless Authority. There's been $1 billion spent. It's seven some odd years since the emergency declared, but we still don't have any results. Let's at least try to see if we can close that disconnect between clearing an encampment and connecting people with services at this location, and then mimic that everywhere else. So we'll see how it goes, how it interacts with the Regional Homelessness Authority, what kind of support there might be on the council, who knows. But at least it's an important discussion to have, and something must be done about the encampment I was at yesterday.
Current News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. This morning, a sweet gesture from a new Harvard grad has gone viral. Here's CBS's Natasha Larno.
When Natalie was just a little girl, her mom, Veronica, risked her life crossing the U.S.-Mexico border to offer her daughter a better future. And now, Natalie just crossed the Harvard graduation stage, so she made sure to celebrate her mom's sacrifices on the important day.
It was a spur of the moment kind of thing. I was taking my graduation pictures, and while being there at the library, I thought, you know, wouldn't it be beautiful for me to take my graduation ensemble, which really is the result of all my mom's sacrifices, and placing it on her.
Veronica, who raised Natalie all by herself, made the hard decision to leave her home country to make sure that her daughter could one day have the life she never did.
My mom wakes up from Monday to Friday at 4 a.m. to work at a poultry plant. It's a very physically demanding job. She works 8 to 10 hour shifts. She's always been my biggest inspiration.
Veronica, who grew up with 11 siblings, was raised in a poor rural area of Mexico and didn't have the opportunity to obtain an education beyond middle school.
And that's why, to me, being able to dedicate my cap and gown to my mom, it meant the world. And I'm a firm believer that the education is liberation.
Wow. Graduating from Harvard.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Testimony yesterday before the January 6th committee. Let's go to CBS correspondent Scott McFarlane in Washington, D.C. In the testimony by Cassidy Hutchinson yesterday, did you see evidence of a direct order from President Trump for a violent attack on the Capitol?
I think Hutchinson's testimony certainly connects Trump's indifference or his concern about crowd size to the violent attack at the Capitol. What she said in her testimony, what the committee has been presenting, is that there was a known risk that day. Not only people who are reported to be armed, but armed with guns or AR-15s in close proximity to key landmarks and government buildings in Washington. According to the testimony, Hutchinson said Trump wanted the metal detectors gone because he wanted the crowd to come near the White House anyhow, thinking he wasn't in danger, and was charitably ambivalent, if not completely indifferent, to the crowd then going to the Capitol, where police were already being overwhelmed and where a mob was forming.
And there's this storyline, too, that he was somewhat out of control that day, possibly assaulting the Secret Service. I've seen different reports that the Secret Service is going to say, no, that never happened. What are your sources telling you?
Well, the picture painted yesterday by Cassidy Hutchinson was of an unhinged person, somebody throwing plates, and according to her account, she'd heard that he had an altercation in the White House Beast limousine, trying to force it to go to the Capitol as the mob was arriving there. There's a bit of asymmetry to all this. You know, this was a woman testifying under oath under the pain of perjury before a congressional committee, saying she heard about an altercation in a White House vehicle. And the pushback comes from an unnamed source close to the Secret Service, tells CBS News that the limousine driver and the head of the Secret Service detail would testify under oath that President Trump did not lunge at the steering wheel and that they were not, quote, attacked by Trump in the Beast, the vehicle. So it's a bit apples and oranges here. We have somebody testifying under oath and somebody giving an unnamed response with specific granular language. Let's see how that plays out over the next 24 hours.
Yeah, my understanding is that the committee would be more than happy for that Secret Service agent to appear and testify, and they would be more than happy for Mark Meadows himself to come and testify under oath. Any indication that that will ever happen?
Felt like yesterday with Cassidy Hutchinson, they were baiting the hook for Mark Meadows.
That's what I thought, too.
He has been the star in the playbill, the top name in the cast of people they want to talk to. Mark Meadows is the epicenter of where this investigation has been headed in terms of witnesses. The prosecution, the U.S. Department of Justice, will not be charging Mark Meadows with contempt of Congress. They've made that decision. But Meadows, his emails, his phones, his testimony, the committee is so craving it. By putting Cassidy Hutchinson in front of America to tell her story, they've raised the pressure on Meadows to finally yield.
There was also the implication that some witness tampering is going on in the form of texts to Trump people, Trump staffers, saying, we're watching you. We're reading all the transcripts. Mm-hmm. We know what you're saying. What about that?
That was quite a punctuation to the hearing. The vice chair, Liz Cheney, saying that they have seen this increasingly and that they're concerned about it moving forward, that witnesses who cooperate are getting the screws turned on them, and that witnesses who might otherwise come forward are being deterred from coming forward by these pressure campaigns. This is what the criminal justice system may call witness tampering, which is not only a crime, but a serious one. The committee has been trying to get the attention of the U.S. Justice Department. That has been a primary part of their mission. They want charges filed. They want the Justice Department to pay mind to what they've found. This is another bell they're ringing that might resonate with the Justice Department.
And I've seen speculation as to what type of charges that they are pointing towards with all this testimony and the public hearings. What are you hearing as far as charges?
That's the big question that remains. That's the question that underscores all of this. There are two separate investigations, the Justice Department criminal investigation of people charged with crimes January 6th, and this separate, unique legislative committee investigation. The question is, will those two parallel investigations ever intersect? Will the Justice Department say this summer, we're going to charge some people with crimes because of what this committee found? Or will the committee say, in so many words, Justice Department, you must charge these people with crimes based on what we found? If those two parallel lines intersect, that's what this has all been about. If they don't, this may yield very little to satisfy people who want more accountability for January 6th.
I got the impression from the committee chairman, Benny Thompson, that there are more Cassidy Hutchinsons out there.
Yeah, I think there are more witnesses that we don't know about or may have who may be more resonating than we know about. The committee has forecast at least two more hearings coming in July. I'll tell you what, if I was in Vegas, Dave, I would bet the over with all my money in the mortgage that they're going to have more than two hearings, because this is a fluid investigation. They have secured the attention of America. They have momentum. They've got a lot to show.
CBS's Scott McFarland. Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you. You can ring my bell. Ring the
bell. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Few diseases are as scary as Alzheimer's, but there is some hopeful new research. Here's Cairo News Radio's Rachel Bell.
June is Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month. And while there is still so little we know about Alzheimer's and dementia, there are some big shifts happening and new resources right here in Seattle. Let's start with the first ever Alzheimer's drug approved by the FDA last summer. Here's Dr. Maria Carrillo, Chief Science Officer for the Alzheimer's Association.
While not a cure, this new drug is the first FDA-approved treatment that has been shown to reduce the defining brain changes of Alzheimer's, those amyloid plaques. People could have more time to participate actively in their daily life more independently and hold on to memories longer. And having more time at these earliest stages in a progressive and fatal disease like Alzheimer's, that actually at the end stage robs you of just even your personhood, this is actually so important.
Dr. Carrillo says there are currently three other drugs in the pipeline awaiting FDA approval. A recent study believes that 40% of what causes Alzheimer's or dementia is dictated by lifestyle. So they're preparing to launch a two-year, $100 million study to look at four factors.
The first is monitoring your heart health. If you have heart disease, you increase your risk of a dementia, including Alzheimer's, by threefold. Cardiovascular diseases, these all actually interfere with blood flow. So they're going to interfere with allowing nutrition to optimally reach the brain, allowing the toxins to be optimally removed. The second, maintain yourself physically active. The third is to ensure that you have the appropriate nutrition, not only for your heart, but for your brain. And the fourth is that you participate in what we're calling cognitive engagement. Your brain active, not just your body.
At the end of March, the Memory Hub opened in Seattle on the Frye Art Museum campus.
The types of programs you might see in a senior center, but really tailored toward the strengths and the needs of people with memory loss and their families.
That's Mary Grace Becker, director of the Memory Hub. It's operated by the UW Memory and Brain Wellness Center, but four other organizations offer on-site programs, making it a one-stop shop for those with dementia and their families and caretakers.
To your question about, is there anything else like this? I want to say no. We like to think of ourselves certainly as on the leading edge of opportunities for people with memory loss and their family members to connect and be supportive and engaged within a welcoming community space like this.
Longtime Seattle nonprofit Elderwise is on campus leading an adult day program.
Persons with memory loss are engaged in conversation, gentle exercise, watercolor painting or other arts engagement. They may also be going out and enjoying. We have an outdoor memory garden space.
A group called Full Life Care focuses on caregiver support and education for both professionals and family members.
So they have a 6-week caregiver education program, as well as individualized coaching.
More than 6 million Americans over 65 are living with various forms of dementia.
You know, here in Washington, there's over 110,000 people who live with dementia and another 300,000+ family caregivers. And here in King County, the numbers are, you know, hovering around 30,000 people with memory loss or dementia. So that's a lot.
The programs at the Memory Hub are open to the community. No insurance necessary. You can find more information at mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
Wow, what a great resource, Rachel. I'm kind of curious if you know what's in the memory garden. What makes it a memory garden?
Yeah, I don't know all of the details because I was supposed to go down there and check it out. And to be completely honest, I got COVID and so I wasn't able to go.
Darn.
But I still wanted to talk to her and do the story anyway. But they said that, you know, they know that using your brain and having kind of like for toddlers, seriously, like that hand and mind connection is very useful. Like doing art is very useful. One of the things that she said when I asked, you know, what can we do with our brains to make sure that we might not have memory loss when we're older? And, you know, they say use your mind, but you really have to use it in a way that almost hurts your brain. Like she compared it to the way that you build up muscle in your body. You know, you want to lift weights and it's not comfortable when you're lifting them. That's how you get bigger muscles. And with your brain, you know, if you do the crossword puzzle every day, that's not that hard. It's not going to really expand your mind in the way that will keep it healthy enough to possibly prevent something like Alzheimer's.
It's not. I struggle with crosswords.
well, if you struggle with it, then it's good.
Oh, good.
So okay. But if it's something that other people say, oh, that's hard, and you're like, it's easy for me, then that doesn't really count. So, you know, learning a new language, that really, really pushes your mind, like anything that makes you feel uncomfortable. And this was all fascinating for me because I actually don't know that much about this disease, and you heard how many people are living with it. So I think the Memory Hub, I want people to learn about this, to know that you have a lot of support out there that's open for you and your family.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you will never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.